talk about confrontation on the road. So here are a number of caveats are necessary first. So once upon a time, the caveat I had to give was that I was among the first people who talked about the Rav's philosophy who had never had the experience of the Rav. And that was the caveat that lots of other people were talking about the Rav and, you know, could say, and when he said to me, he said this. I could never do that. I saw the Rav once in my life at an assembly when the brief time I spent in MTAs as a freshman. So the Rav went to the front of the room on Rosh Chodesh, and I got to see him there, and that was it. So I had no personal contact with the Rav, and that in itself is a shift. Now I have to add to that in addition to not having had any personal contact with the Rav, I have also not read anything really of the Rav that has come out since the classical era. I haven't read any of the new books, so my understanding of the Rav is, you know, limited to that sort of snapshot in time when you could read everything that he had published in his lifetime, but hadn't actually met him. There are obviously perspectives that are gained from both of those that I'm lacking. At the same time, like everyone else of my generation, in modern Orthodoxy, forming a hashkafa meant either that you agreed with the Rav or you rebelled against the Rav, but it wasn't possible to form a hashkafa which wasn't framed in reference to the Rav. I actually went through stages this way. At an early stage in high school, Halachic Man, the first six pages, and particularly the long footnote, I don't know if it's still known as that, the long footnote, in which he talks about how religion is all about struggle and paradox, and people who think that Mizmor Chaf Gimel, which he refers to as that song we sing at Shal Shittes, I believe, is the dream of religion, you know, to lie down by cool pastures, whatever it may be, if we have a word for that, it's called Christian Science. Right? It's a very powerful footnote, and that was tremendously helpful to me at the time when I was somebody who had lots of questions and troubles, and in the high school I ended up in, that was not the model of religiosity that you were supposed to have. It was supposed to be emunah pshuta. So that was really tremendously helpful to me. Unfortunately, right after that long footnote, there is the section in Greek letters, which totally intimidated me. That's where I gave up. And that was that. So I didn't pick up Halachic Man again until afterwards. I could also have been intimidated by the word stygic, which I believe appears there somewhere, which is a story I love to tell. There's the word stygic. Now, stygic in Halachic is a translation of the Hebrew, because Isha Halacha is written in Hebrew, in which it says sticky. But if you look up stygic, I don't believe you can find it. And I asked Professor Kaplan what stygic meant, and he told me, I don't know if he was joking or not, he told me that he didn't know either, he was just transliterating sticky. So you could have given up on stygic as much as me, I get right. It must have meant something once. But it doesn't. Whatever it meant is apparently now lost in antiquity. I spent time in college explaining why I was different than the Rav and rebelling against the Rav theologically, but still defining myself in terms of that. So when I first came to Maimonides, I spent my first senior year explaining to the students. Which I thought would be to their great excitement, and it was sort of this frisson of risk that I would explain to them how I thought things differently than the Rav did, and that I thought would both shock and titillate Maimonides students. Turned out that they had no idea what the Rav had said whatsoever. They had no idea anything I said was different. That was the first lesson that was the lesson that Rabbi Farber had taught me, that being a Mechadesh is only useful if people have expectations of what you're going to say. Right? If they don't know what you're supposed to say, then there's no chiddush about it. This is also the point that T.S. Eliot makes in his essay Tradition and the Individual Talent, that creativity only makes sense against the background of a tradition. Creativity without a tradition is randomness, because nobody can tell the difference. Right? Anybody could say anything. Right? There's nothing creative about it at all. Then, somewhere in the middle of my Maimonides experience, I started discovering that, first of all, really had a number of experiences where I understood the Rav in ways that out of depth I had never understood before, and recognizing, and this is perhaps a metaphor for a relationship with many aspects of Torah, that actually when I really understood him, I agreed a lot more. Now that sometimes entailed understanding him in ways that no one else had understood him previously, and so therefore you can argue that these are projections. But I found myself coming to terms. The big issue really was about whether he thought practical halacha was really just a small, insignificant aspect of the of Talmud Torah, which is what he sounds it sounds like he says in Ish Halacha, or whether he was just saying that from a particular religious perspective, which was not his, which is where I ended up coming out. So then I ended up becoming much more of a Rav Chassid. Somewhere in that, I guess somewhere when I was still in that stage, and I'm not sure where I am right now, I was asked by Professor Ruth Langer at Boston College to be the respondent to a symposium about confrontation. It was about 12 or 13 years ago, which was an interesting challenge to me, because my understanding of the Rav was really, I had this big reading of Halachic Man and Halachic Mind and Halachic Man, which was one really big piece, and I had tried to teach Lonely Man of Faith in Maimonides in Tanakh classes with varying success, in the sense of my understanding it, almost unmitigated lack of success in terms of the students, I think. Although I hope it was a cool experience that they tried, and got some cool papers attempting. So this is an essay that I had heard of, but I'd never actually read. And so it was a really fascinating experience trying to work it out. And I still have a reading which apparently is wholly idiosyncratic and that no one else ever references. And which changes if you look at the Boston College Conference records, you'll see that my written presentation is significantly different than the oral presentation. I think that the written presentation is better. But even there, the only issue I was really addressing in terms of confrontation was the attitude towards interfaith dialogue in Christianity in particular, which is what the pragmatic purpose of the essay is to set out an approach to interfaith dialogue, and which entails to some degree a response to Christianity. But as you all probably know better than I, the Rav tends not to address practical issues in purely practical terms, right? Usually he builds this very, very large philosophic infrastructure in advance. And so confrontation takes a very long time to get around to talking about Christianity and other things. And I don't know whether this was an essay he always wanted to write and this was a pragmatic excuse for doing it, or whether he really just felt that in order to address the issue of how to engage in interfaith dialogue, it is necessary to build this entire infrastructure. But my interest for us today in the summer is not so much in, or not, in fact, not at all, in the attitude, in the end of the essay, in the attitude towards Christianity. I have an interest in that per se. If we have time left at the end, I'm happy to talk about what my theory is about the overall essay, and we can debate that. But it happens that it begins with an analysis of the role of aesthetics, which is what we're interested in. Now, we should be upfront, this is not the only place where the Rav talks about aesthetics, and in fact it is very different, I believe, from some of the other places. I think that Sherbet Spiro has an essay in which he talks in general about the Rav's aesthetic theory. It may even be a whole book. And he puts together a whole bunch of places where the Rav talks about aesthetics, and some of which I'm familiar with, some of which I'm not, and we could talk about that generally. But I'm interested today in just reading this particular essay, which says some fairly stark things, and we'll see whether we agree with them. We'll see if we can understand them and see whether we agree with them. I haven't done this before, so I just want to read it together and see if we can understand what he says, and if we can understand what he says here, which, again, I think if you decide you disagree with it, I don't think that you have to feel yourself in rebellion against the Rav per se, because you might just be agreeing with him somewhere else. This is just being written, right? This is just being written for this essay. But I want to understand what he says and why he says it, because I think it does present one particular position on the relationship between aesthetics and religiosity that is valuable to take into account. Okay, here we go. Shocking, right? The biblical account of the creation of man portrays him at three progressive levels. Okay, good. And we're really only interested in the first level now, because the whole discussion of art takes place only in the first level, by the time we get to 2 and 3, whatever 2 and 3 are, which is in the Mafokit, then he's already long lost aesthetics. Okay, so at the first level, he appears as a simple, natural being. He is neither cognizant of his unique station in the cosmos, nor burdened by the awareness of the paradoxical capability of being concurrently free and obedience, creative to the point of self-transcendence, and submissive in a manner bordering on self-effacement. So here we have all the classic fakiras. First of all, right, I'm reading this as there are two disjunctions. The paradoxes are A, concurrent free and obedience, and right, those are two poles of the paradox, and the second poles are creative to the point of self-transcendence, and on the other hand, submissive in a manner bordering on self-effacement. So that creative to the point of self-transcendence is not itself a paradox. She might have argued that greater than the point of self-transcendence paradox, and probably that free is parallel to creative to the point of self-transcendence, and obedience is parallel to submissive to the point of self-effacement. So really, it's just one fakir. All right. So with that, assuming that, or disagreeing with that, so how do you understand? Right. So what is the paradox?
Which one, the free and obedient one?
I
seems fairly straightforward.
Yeah, why is the paradox to be free and obedient?
Because if you're free, then you are your own master, and if you're obedient, then someone else is your master.
Why? Why can't you choose freely to obey?
Well, why can't you obey somebody to be free?
I don't know. All right, if somebody orders you to be free, they might argue that's a paradox because I'm not really being free. Right, I'm listening. Right, but if you if you have the capacity to choose whether to be obedient, then you are already free.
Okay, well, no, because then you're free at the point where you made that choice, you could say, right? And then once you give up your freedom, then now you're no longer free. So you were free, and then you stopped being free.
Uh-huh. So you're saying, so obedient doesn't mean that you are choosing to obey. Obedient means that really what you mean by obedient is that you are committing in advance all obedience. Right, so the question is whether once you say Na'aseh V'Nishma, right? So it's free to say Na'aseh V'Nishma, but then having said Na'aseh V'Nishma, you're no longer free. Which you could solve chronologically by saying we used to be free and now we said Na'aseh V'Nishma, but he doesn't want to say that. Right? He says that we're concurrently free and obedient. Right, so that's right. So that's right. So the real question is how can you actually be free in the presence of a commitment, right? The question is whether a commitment to obedience removes your freedom. Right, that's what it sounds. And is this the same as creative? How does freedom relate to creativity? Creativity is the point of self-transcendence.
And that one is less about creation and submission, which are not paradoxes, but self-transcendence and self-effacement, which, I guess if you do the creativity and the submissiveness to the nth degree, you both have self-transcendence and self-effacement, which is more of a paradox.
Why are self-transcendence and self-effacement paradoxes as opposed to the same thing?
Because they mean different things.
Good. So tell me what self-transcendence means. It sounds to me like the self gets lost in both of them.
Well, in self-transcendence, the self, you could say, is lost, and then you are above the self. And in self-effacement, I wouldn't say the self is lost. I would just say that it is effaced. And B, that the self is somehow lower down than it had been.
Could be. I still want a better definition of effaced as opposed to effaced. That doesn't help me so much. Yes, Yudhya.
Well, you could say the self-transcendence is in creation is sort of extending yourself beyond the limits of yourself, right? Self-transcendence doesn't nullify yourself. Actually, it's saying that, you know, yourself actually becomes even bigger than your original body, and creating is right a mode of self-affirmation because you're basically molding the rest of the world in your own image. So in that sense, a creative sort of a creation is can be a sort of selfish and self-affirming activity, whereas right, submission then is the opposite. It's self-nullification.
Hmm. Okay, I want to suggest, all right, that what he's talking about here is his conception of tshuva. Right, and in his conception of tshuva, right, the claim is that the ultimate freedom and right, the ultimate freedom is the capacity to create, because create yesh me'ayin. Because the capacity to create yesh me'ayin means that there's no right, you're not bound by anything in existence. Right, so creativity here is distinct from the capacity to reform. Right, creativity is the capacity to produce, right, in the right, without being constrained by material. And then in tshuva he argues that the ultimate freedom and the ultimate creative act is the capacity to remake the self. You're not right, not only you're not constrained by anything external, you're also not constrained by anything about yourself. So I think that when he sees creativity as on an arc, which the ultimate end is self transcendence, it means that the ultimate creative capacity is the capacity to remake the self. So that you're not bound by anything else, and that's why I think that's the connection between, that's why freedom, creativity, and self transcendence all mean the same. Are all the same thing. Whereas obedience is being bounded. Right, all the other things are being bounded. If you put the three roles on an axis, the ultimate freedom is that you're not constrained by anything, even the self. Whereas you can be limited. You can be limited by a set of three things. You can be limited by your own nature. You can be limited by the nature of things external to you. Or, right, the ultimate limitation is you can be limited by somebody else's will. Right, because that you have no control at all. Right, because if you are bounded by somebody else's will, and that somebody else or something else has complete freedom, that means you have no choices at all, because any choice that you make can be completely undone by the other person's will. Right, so that's why I think he sets that out. Right, that really the poles are the capacity to remake the self, and the situation in which everything you do is subject to another will. Right, so there's nothing you can do that has any real meaning in the face of that. Okay, so I think he sets that out as the poles. Okay, right, but now we're talking about a simple natural being is not aware of this paradox. Now the question is, not being aware of this paradox, which does that mean that you're aware of one but not the other? Or that you're aware of neither? Right, so I suggest that what he means is that a simple natural being is neither aware of being free nor of being obedient, or even of the capacity to be obedient. What does that mean? Right, at this stage, natural man is irresponsive to the pressure of both the imperative from without and the ought from within. Okay, so that's it. Right, so this is a large move, right? Because right now he has a claim that commandedness. Right, whether commandedness in the sense of heteronomy or commandedness in the sense of autonomy, is only possible for somebody who is aware both of their own capacity for complete creativity and of their capacity to have no room for maneuver at all. Right, that's a big move. He doesn't explain to you why that happens. Right, how is it that those are connected, and it's also a very strong claim, which makes three logical claims that commandedness is a function of both heteronomy and autonomy, that there's an ought from within, because you might take a very good Jewish theology and say that commandedness means that there's a God who is wholly other, and commandedness simply means that you accept the command of the other. Now seven ishmael means. A seven ishma means complete, right? Complete surrender. But what he tells you, I think, right? If we assume that we're working on the same chakira, what he tells you is that the commandedness has to come from both freedom Right? And freedom generates autonomous command, and from right and from obedience, which is heteronomous command. So to really right, so, right, and that right claim is that if you are fully free, then you can be aware of the pressure from the imperative from within. And if you're fully obedient, you can be aware of the pressure from without, and you have to have both to be responsive to both pressures. She calls the inner qualities of humanity surging de profundis, where we have Latin and Hebrew to intimidate the Catholics, I guess. Right? We get intimidated by the Latin, they get intimidated by the Hebrew, and everybody's all together until they get to Greek and German, and then then we get intimidated by everybody but Professor Brill. Okay. Right, for the norm, either from within or without, addresses itself only to man who is sensitive to his own incongruity and tragic dilemma. The word tragedy starts coming in here a lot, and to do that, probably understand that you have to read a lot of Nietzsche, and I haven't read so much enough Nietzsche to really talk about why he likes saying tragic a lot. Okay, the illusory happy-mindedness of natural man stands behind him in the norm. So there we have happy-mindedness as opposed to tragedy. Now again, as a high school student, I was really happy with the attack on happy-mindedness. What I say often is that I discovered being a parent that happiness was a lot more important than I thought it was. Right, as a teenager, I thought it more than as a teenager, like, you know, as a pre-parent. So, you know, all that matters is depth. Who cares about happiness? Happiness is for shallow people. But as a parent, it turns out that happiness matters. You want your kids to be happy, and, you know, you look at your kids saying a really deep sadness, and you say, that's a really deep sadness. No, it's not. That's an important philosophic revelation. That happiness matters in spouses. It matters in spouses too. Okay, but the illusory happy man, as a natural man, stands between him and the norm, because now we have another move, right? Natural man, unaware of the element of tension prevailing between the human being and the environment of which he is an integral part, has no need to live a normative life, and to find redemption in surrender to a higher moral will. Okay, now we have a whole set of new terms. That need to be put in. So, the awareness of both freedom and obedience is something unique to human beings, and therefore makes human beings something other than the natural order. Because the natural order has no freedom, and no capacity for obedience. Apparently, maybe it just has no freedom and it just obeys anyway. I'm not sure which. Okay. But now we have like one of the really big terms in the realm, which I'm hoping that one of you can explain to me usefully, which is redemption. What is redemption? Right? Why do you need to find redemption and surrender? What are you being redeemed from? Right? Redemption is like one of the key terms all over the realm. Right? Redeemed existence, things like that. So how do you understand that term? Yes, you do.
I mean, it seems like it's something that would be like some kind of existential validation of your life.
Okay.
That's what I said.
Okay, existential validation.
That only sort of sophisticated thinking religious beings can have.
But redemption usually solves a problem, right? It means your life is not valid without it.
Yeah, because we have that problem.
Which right? problem?
That we're bothered by the meaninglessness of our lives.
Uh-huh. We're bothered by the meaninglessness of our lives. So
right,
there's
I mean,
a new
right. You take meaning in the wide sense of what I just talked before. Right?
Uh-huh. Okay. We can try with this. Let's play it out, right? So you have natural man who is happy or happy-minded, and because he's happy-minded, he doesn't see any purpose in norms. Right. Norms emerge from this element of tension between human beings and their environment. And when you are aware of that tension, then you need norms in order to find redemption. And redemption here comes not from surrender, from recognizing the ought from within, but the ought from without. It's a higher moral will.
It seems like it's recognizing ought in general.
So why does he have to say higher moral will then? Why will? Why does he need will?
Well,
Unless you think it's your own higher moral will.
As opposed to just the world around you. Not that it's a will as opposed to another will.
Okay, so maybe it preserves both the ought and the ought from without and within. Okay, I'm willing to go with that. So his existence is unbounded, merging harmoniously with the general order of things and events. He is united with nature, moving straight forwards. I don't think that works in English. With the beast and fowl of the field, along an unbroken line of mechanical life activities, never turning around, never glancing backwards. This I don't think he was referring to a 60s song. Although it would have been cool if you broke into, you know, ain't going to let nobody turn me around. It could be an attack on it. I don't think so. Right? Leading an existence with which is neither fraught with contradiction, nor perplexed by paradoxes, nor marred by fright. Okay. Whether we can completely parse this philosophically or not, we get the sense that there is a stage of being in which norms are irrelevant, because people are unaware of paradoxes, and I think this is important for the world generally, that they're also not aware of fright, although it's not going to work so well philosophically, because you have to claim that animals don't express fear, all sorts of, right, which is going to be a little bit problematic. Okay.
What do you mean by fear?
Yeah, right, so we'll redefine fear, of course. Okay, so now this moves into the Pasuk V'chol Siach Sadeh Terem Yeh Ba'aretz V'chol Eitzev HaSadeh Terem Yitzmach V'Adam Ayin Lavodet Ha'Adamah ועד יעלה מן הארץ וישקעת כל פני האדמה, וייצר השם את האדם עפר מן האדמה, ויפח באפיו נשמת חיים, ויהי האדם לנפש חיה. Now the Rav is going to claim that having a nishmat chayim does not in any way change you from being natural. Right? He's going to read the nishmat chayim as simply being a nefesh chaya, like every other nefesh chaya, as opposed to that. Which is where we get this wonderful image of the Eid Olam Min Ha'aretz, the Eid Olam Min Ha'aretz as a mist arising from the jungle. A wonderfully fun translation. I don't know if any of you have ever thought of it that way. Right, where Gan Eden,
jungle?
Mist arising from the jungle. That's what he says. Enveloped in a mist rising from the jungle. I think that's a wonderful moment of creative interpretation. I never thought of Gan Eden as the primeval jungle. But you look at it and you say, oh, that's what it was. Really, really cool. If I bring in that book with God as the architect in the yellow hat, you'll see that they do a really good job of portraying Gan Eden as the primeval jungle, where everyone's playing with animals and, you know, riding on leopards and things like that. Very cool. Okay. In a word, this man is a non-confronted being, right? So being non-confronted means that there is nothing that is facing you. It's not referring necessarily to an aggressive confrontation. Right? It means that there's nothing in front of you that looks back at you. Right? Okay, fine. Now we get to the necessary boilerplate where, shockingly, the Rav is not talking about ancient primeval man, but is really talking about something, right, part of the nature of humanity per se. I'm sure that even for those of you who had never read this essay, this did not come as a great shock, that he was right, that we were not engaged in a portrayal of the Urmensch. Okay, right, not in anthropological or in typological categories, right, okay, fine. But now, if we get to the move that is most relevant to us, right? Non-confronted man is to be found not only in the cave or the jungle, but also in the seats of learning in the halls of the philosophers, not so much our issue, and artists. Because it applies to human existence, no matter how cultured and sophisticated, because now we have a move. Natural man is the same as the, however you pronounce that word, oriented, egocentric person, the beauty worshipper, committed to the goods of sense and craving exclusively for boundless aesthetic experience, the voluptuary, inventing needs in order to give himself the opportunity of continual gratification, the sybarite, constantly discovering new areas of pleasure as pursuit and happiness found and lost, leads a non-confronted existence. At this stage, the intellectual gesture is not the ultimate goal, which apparently another stage it will be, right? But a means to another end, the attainment of unlimited aesthetic experience. Okay, so this is a very big move, right? Because What this does, in a sense, right, you can claim, is that there is a, so probably most of you are familiar with the machloket between Bentham and Mill within utilitarianism. Right, Bentham is utilitarian, right, thinks that all that matters is pleasure and pain. And, right, maximize pleasure, right, maximize the, I don't know if it's the pleasure-pain ratio or the absolute difference between pleasure, the absolute difference in pleasure and your pain in your life. I'm not an expert on this. The problem with that is that if you have a purely quantitative measure of pleasure and pain, so then you end up basically trying to maximize pornography. Right, because that's an easy form of a great deal of pleasure, and there isn't so much room for fine wines or for paintings. So Bentham doesn't apparently have room. Again, I'm just spouting at you what I learned in college classes. All right, doesn't have room for qualitative distinctions among pleasures. So Mill introduces the difference between higher and lower pleasures, right, which enables you to claim that that spending a lot of time looking at abstract art, right, and enabling people to look at abstract art is more important than enabling people to have crude physical pleasures.
But even he just claims that they're there, right?
It's philosophical, right? It's an assertion, right, that we can distinguish. So what I want to suggest here is that what the Rav is doing is taking the Bentham position, essentially. Right, he says, right, because when you equate the pleasure worshipper, the sybarite, the person who's only interested in pleasure, with the people who are searching for boundless aesthetic experience, you're saying it doesn't matter what kind of aesthetic experience they want. Right, all of this becomes a form of sensual experience. Which is true, right? Because the experience of beauty is whatever kind of beauty it is, it's a physical experience that translates, and all that, right? Anybody whose life is organized around the search for aesthetic experience, whether that is the aesthetic, right, that is crude aesthetic experience, or the worship of beauty in a very high level, right? That's why it's found in the halls of artists. All that is, right, anybody for whom the ultimate goal is unlimited aesthetic experience of whatever form is a non-confronted being who fails to recognize what is essential about human beings, which is that they are different than nature, they can win freedom, and then they can sacrifice that freedom, and then we get all the rhetoric about that again. Right. Yes, Emily?
Would you say that's changed based on whether there's intellect mixed with it?
No, because at this stage, the intellectual gesture is just a means, right? There is a stage at which being rational, thinking, is an end. But for a person at this stage, the only reason you think is so that you can have the experience. So somebody who spent their entire life studying chemistry so that they could mix different pigments, right? Or studying art history so they can better appreciate it, or studying what, right? Doesn't matter to him at all. Right, because at this stage, right, because without consciousness of confrontation, nothing else, right, nothing rises, nothing is redeemed. Right, I think that's his claim. You can be a philosopher, or you can be an artist, right, which means you can be as good, right, so it doesn't matter which area you excel at, it doesn't matter in the slightest as long as you're not confronted.
So there's never room for confrontation of this sort within the pursuit of aesthetic pleasure?
Okay, so I said if your end is the pursuit of aesthetic pleasure.
If what?
If your end, right, if the thing you're striving for is aesthetic pleasure, then there's no room.
Okay.
Right. Now there may be room for redeemed aesthetic experience. Right? But when you see aesthetic experience as the end, there's no room for norms. Right? I think that's the contention he's making, and that's going to be a powerful thing for us, right? Because you can translate that easily into art for art's sake. Yes, you do.
But interestingly, right, if you view aesthetic experience as the end, right, then you've already sort of imposed a norm on yourself, right? Because you're saying, oh, we ought to go in search of right a thing. It seems like what he's describing is even less than right. He's less than that. It's not somebody who's like right consciously decided to right appropriate an end for themselves. it's just, it's a more, right, it's a more base instinctual, you know, grasping after the shiny thing type of, right, pursuit of art.
So that's a, you know, it's an interesting question of how plausible this is, right? You know, he's ultimately claiming that you can spend your life doing philosophy or painting.
These are ideal people, right?
But he wants to claim, right, that, you know, that they come out in that state, right? So that's a, I think that's an interesting, I think it's an interesting critique. Well, he doesn't address, really, I guess you could claim, the people who see aesthetics as a norm. Right, he assumes that the search for, right, even people who worship aesthetics, right?
Right, I mean, right, to say to worship aesthetics is a non-religious experience, right, it seems a little, like a little bit of a self-contradiction.
Good. I think that's right. I think that's a, and again, I'm not claiming that, you know, that this is a problem with the Rav or the understanding I'd say, but it's, if we understood the Rav the way I was setting him out, then I think that is right. I think that's going to be, that's exactly the kind of tension that we're pointing out in the right, in the whole framing of the summer, right? Is it possible to view as the aesthetic experience as a redeemed end, as opposed to an unredeemed end, right? So that's exactly it, right? Yes, Miriam?
And also, in terms of the idea of art for art's sake, and that has a lot of, in addition to art being a goal, there's also a sort of for the other person kind of goal, where you create art not just for yourself, and whether it's for art's sake or for another person's sake, where what he's talking about seems to be much more about the individual desire for pleasure, which the individual does through pursuit of art, whether creating it or finding it. But it's more about the individual's pursuit for art as opposed to the idea of making art or having
it. Anyway, what happens if you want to, it's not your desire for experience, but what happens if you want to produce art so other people can have experiences?
He doesn't seem to be.
He doesn't address that at all, right? That's an excellent, right? That's an excellent point also. Right. Yes, Yuda.
That essentially the same thing. You want other people to enjoy your art, but then that gives you the pleasure of letting other people enjoy your work.
But is that an aesthetic pleasure?
Yeah. And even if it's a different kind, it's essentially the same thing. It's pursuit of pleasure directly.
And does that mean that the kind of person who gives people, who gives lots of stucca generally because they like having other people, they like seeing other people be happy, is a non-confronted, unredeemed being?
You could say that, but it would...
What's the difference whether I create art for other
people? It depends on your motivation. Do you want other people to enjoy your art, or do you want to enjoy other people looking at your art? Do you like the feeling of people praising your work and saying you're good at it? Or do you...
The way you're praising your work, that's different.
No, that's what I'm talking about. Like, if it was anonymous, let's say you want an anonymous ad, and I agree, that's different.
Aha, okay, that's true, I agree. But I'm not sure that wanting praise is sense gratification either. Right? I'm not sure that's the same thing. Wanting praise is actually already a stage which you recognize others.
I guess, yes.
It's very hard to sustain this position of, you know, being of an artist who's so. But we'll find out, right? Because it may be that you'll discover that some artists express themselves exactly that way, right? I don't care about the audience. It's not about, right? It's not about, if no one ever sees it, it'll matter, right? It doesn't matter in the slightest thing. What matters to me is. And then, now, again, the question is, if somebody says, what I want is, if somebody says, I just want the most pleasure, so it's easy to see this, but I think the Rav goes out of his way to say, it's not just the question, I want the most pleasure. Even if somebody says, I want the highest pleasure, that's not any different. And that's where I think that the move is challenging. Not indefensible, but challenging. And that where we may wish to take issue. Okay, then we get into all sorts of fun biblical interpretation. We start with right, beauty, uncouth and unrefined, but irresistible. So now there again, uncouth and unrefined. So what happens if you're talking about a highly couth and refined beauty? Right? I'm not sure this is a fair move. Emerges first in the biblical reading according to the midrash quoted by Ramban. It's not quite as wild as talking about Mizmor Chaf Gimel as a song we sing at Shal Shittas, but still kind of fun that it's not the Midrash quoted by Ramban. We wouldn't do that anymore. Now we would say the Midrash in such and such a collection. But back then you could say the Midrash quoted by Ramban and deal with that. Right, in the person of Na'ama, right, and he gives you the story in which Na'ama's beauty is what drives that story. It's also a fun Madeleine L'Engle novel about this. Her seductive charms captivated the sons of the mighty, right, which we talked about at the point of what B'nai Elohim means, and led to their appalling disregard for the central divine norm enjoining man from reaching out for the fascinating and beautiful that does not belong to him. Okay, so this is a right, so this is a right, this there's a number of really fascinating claims claims in this. Right, so first of all, it claims the central divine norm is property. Right, it claims the central norm is lo tigzol as opposed to lo tignov, as opposed to lo tirtach or madalach sani lecharech latavid. Central divine norm is keeping and reaching out for the fascinating and beautiful that does not belong to him. Right, they worship beauty and succumb to its overwhelming impact. So here we have a fascinating notion that the downside of beauty, and beauty is a proxy for sense experience, is that it engenders a desire which makes you unable to recognize the rights of others. Right, that's what the risk of the worship of aesthetics is, that you end up thinking that your need to experience that override is more important than anything else. That's an interesting thing, but it's also true of any other value. Right, your need to what happens if I'm not reaching out for a painting or a beautiful human being, but for a pair of tefillin. Right, so with the same token, the search for religious experience causes one to override the central divine norm, because you really, really want to feel what that pair of film feels like on your arm, or
I think that'd be a ritualistic experience more than a religious experience.
Aha! So you want to argue per se there can't be a religious experience which is accomplished by theft?
It could depend on the religion. I mean, you could have a religion
that's
based off
of this Sunday, right? Which I don't think any of you guys are necessarily going to show up for. I don't think you're supposed to even. I agreed to give this shiur this Sunday on Lo Sachmud because I thought it would tie in very nicely. So one of the really fun shilas of Lo Sachmud is, do you violate Lo Sachmud if you covet somebody else's esrog so that you could use it for the mitzvah? Right, so that seems to suggest, right, that it's possible to have a chemda for, right, and that would be a religious experience, I think. I think, now there is a sheet that there is no problem with that. But even so, it sounds like there is per se an experience of having the right esrog that is a religious experience, not just a ritualistic experience. And that can be a level of losachmod. Losachmod means that combine the halachic definitions, that I want this badly enough that I start thinking about ways in which I could get it from you, right? Because is it usur for me to think of ways which I could persuade you to give me your esrog so I could use it for the mitzvah? And we don't suggest that the very fact that I'm thinking about that way means that it would be a mitzvah babavera, and therefore meaningless. I think the fun way to really analyze the issue would be to talk about mitzvah babavera, and talk about whether the reason that using certain kinds of stolen objects for mitzvot is invalid is because it's not a religious experience as opposed to some other framework. That would be really, it's impossible to have kavana, right? That would be a very neat way of doing it. But
you could say it's not a religious experience, but you could
say
anyway.
Ah, okay, yeah, to talk about the question, right? So you can disassociate the question, you can turn mitzvah babavera into a legalistic conversation. Right, so that's what I wrote about, wasn't it? Yeah, I don't know I published an article in Kalam Avastra this year about whether lumdus and religious experience could be connected at all, which was built around I always thought it was somebody else. But the Michas Chinuch who understands mitzvah babavera in terms of what God wants and God doesn't want, and talk about what for briskers that makes no sense at all. So that's exactly that issue. I can give you that article and you can see if you think at the end of it. Okay. Fine. So Anama, the incarnation of unhallowed and sublimated beauty, is for the Midrash not so much an individual as an idea, not only a real person, but a symbol of unredeemed beauty, and we go on and so forth. There are a number of things here of which I think nowadays turning her into Delilah is not a problem. Calling her into Tamar would be very, very un-PC nowadays. Right? Et cetera. He's not offering an interpretation that makes Tamar guilty. Right? What he's saying is that Tamar, as the symbol of beauty for Amnon, ends up corrupting Amnon. Right? I don't think we would take that chance nowadays of seeming to be blaming the victim. Okay, right. So then we have a fascinating move at the end of section two, which is that man depicted in these verses is hedonically minded and pleasure seeking, having at his disposal a multitude of possibilities of sense gratification. Before him stretches a vast garden with an almost endless variety of trees. I don't know why it's almost endless. Right? Why couldn't it be an endless variety? Right? Koleis l'macha. I don't know what drove this. You know, perhaps there's some really fun position about the impossibility of an infinity. I don't know. Right? Variety of trees, desirable and good, tempting, fascinating, and exciting. The boundless fantasy with their glamorous colors. Okay. Now, obviously, this pasuk leaves out the Eitz HaChaim and the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra. Right, so his rewrite. Right, so it's interesting that his rewrite leaves those out. And presumably that's setting you up at some point, right? Realize if you know, right? If you notice those trees. But what he builds off here is the Rambam in chapter 2 of the Mora, which we may meet at some point this summer, says that the chait of Adam HaRishon was not eating the fruit, or at least not the chait was eating the fruit, but the fall was not eating the fruit. Okay, right. So what causes the fall? Okay, you all understand what I mean by the fall as opposed to the chait. Right. For the Ram, that one of the basic problems that everyone has is how could Adam HaRishon commit the chait? Right. A perfect human, right. There's a paradox. Right. So the answer. So one answer is. That in order to sin, he has to first have fallen. As opposed to saying that, right, so it's not the disobedience that causes the transformation of humanity, it's the transformation of humanity that enables disobedience. Okay, the underlying problem with this whole thing is that, an interesting tension, is that for the Rav, it's the awareness of commandedness that makes you human, and that's, right, and that's a, that seems to suggest, and really the awareness of commandedness really only happens at the moment of chait, so that's the whole, right, that generates a whole interesting thing in interpreting Gan Eden. But in the Rambam, so what causes the fall? When does it happen? And who falls? Adam or Chava?
Chava
falls, right? And when does she fall?
When she listens.
Nope.
She
misinterprets it, that causes the chait. And she listens to Nachash, but if she hadn't fallen, the Nachash said it would just roll off her. Right, what happens, when she listens to Nachash, what happens after that?
She honors her husband. She
sees. Right, so she sees. V'tereisha ki tova es l'machal v'nechmada es l'mare v'tavahi la'inayim. Right, let's look at the actual pasuk. Perek Gimel begins with Nachash Ha'arum, right? So Vatera Isha Kitova Eslam Achal Vikita Avahi La Inaim Venechmada Esl Haskil Vatikah Mi Priyova Tocha Vatengam Lishav Imav Vayuchal v'tipakasna einei shneihem. Okay, so you have this visual, right, this visual image, and for the Rambam, as I understand him, I don't think it's a controversial reading, the fall is when she notices that the tree, right, that the tree is worth looking at. Because in the Rambam's vision, which is also typological, an ultimate human being would not notice sense things at all. Right, would only be interested in ideas, would only notice platonic forms. And certainly wouldn't notice the aesthetic qualities of things. Right, aesthetic qualities are always functions of particulars. Right, you might maybe a beautiful argument could seduce you, but a beautiful fruit never. For the Rambam, the fall of human beings is when they stop thinking about Tovin, about Emet v'Sheker, which are abstractions, and start thinking of Tov and Ra, which are contingent on circumstances. And for him, the symbol of how that happens is when she starts noticing that things are beautiful, which is a property of particulars as opposed to generalities. Right, so the Rambam's reading of the narrative is Vatera Isha is not she was wavering and then sense perception overrode her obedience. It's that she noticed it, and at that point human beings become who they are, which is beings who are subject to temptation. Inevitably, once human beings are subject to temptation, they will fall. So she fell, right? But this way, in the Rambam's narrative of the story of creation, you could tell the story this way. The snake said to the woman something or other. She looked and she said, "Oh my goodness, the tree is beautiful. But God doesn't want me to eat it." And she walks away. And she does this for 500 years. In year 501, all of a sudden, she has a weak moment and she eats the fruit. It doesn't change the story of Gan Eden in the slightest. That's exactly right. Right, because the moment that she notices it, eventually she's going to sin. Kein adam asher bara et asher lo yechta. Right, everybody gives into temptation sometimes. And what really matters to the Rambam is not so much that right, the moment of sin is secondary. Right, you can have a messianic fantasy in which everybody has free will and nobody ever sins. Right, but it's not. Right, that's not. That ties into the whole question of what the Rambam means by Yom HaMashiach. This is the problem the Ramban tries to solve by creating this externalized Yetzirah. Right, the possibility of Yetzirah can be removed, so we can somehow have free will without Yetzirah, and thereby not sin. Even though the Ramban doesn't work either, because ultimately, guess what? So when Mashiach comes, what's God going to do? He's going to take the Yetzirah out of us and put it where? In a snake. Why won't we listen to the snake the second time? Nobody knows. Right, right. So this is for some reason Ramban seems to think this is the same thing that leads one to believe that the first Beis HaMikdash got destroyed, and the second Beis HaMikdash got destroyed, but the third Beis HaMikdash is bound to be eternal. So we can be confident that Zionism, if we only build a Beit HaMikdash, then the world, right, then history would end and life would be perfect. Because after all, the Navi says that the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction only happened once, and we all know that it only happened once, and that's why this third one is going to be true. Anybody follow that? We all know that's the argument, right?
Wait, just go over that one more time.
The argument is that we know from the VM for sure that the Beis HaMikdash will only be destroyed once. And that's already happened. So this one, if we rebuild it, will certainly, right, that Eretz Yisrael will only be destroyed once. Right, the Jews, right? So that's already happened, so we know that this time it's going to stay forever.
So this is, how do you deal with the second one?
How do you deal with the second one, right? How do you guys know how we deal with the second one? Very important, we deal with the second one. The second one wasn't real. The second one was just an illusion of redemption, which was necessary to keep us from being completely assimilated.
Right, and this one is not like that.
But this one is not like that. No, this one is real. Right? We know that.
Oh.
Right? It's very important to understand that, because you might be misled into believing that it happened twice and Navi says it happened once and that would completely destroy your emunah. So I wish to remove that possibility from your head. No, the second one doesn't count, but this one does. Yes, Yehuda.
Thanks for that, such a week. I like the second one doesn't count. I don't know about this one does, but like not all Bnei Yisrael came, but a small percentage.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't such a good thing, like the old men were crying when they saw it. Not such a weak argument to say.
As opposed to this time, where it was greeted with boundless rejoicing among the entire Jewish people who immediately moved there.
I don't know. I'm saying this
time.
Well,
we haven't built yet.
Right?
We
haven't built yet. Well,
it's not finished yet.
But when we build the base of the Mikdash, then, right, it will only happen.
There will be no arguments whatsoever. It will be unanimous.
Everyone will rejoice.
It's a better argument.
Even the vegetarians.
Once everyone
no, but we're not going to build it.
We
got to
the point where
everyone
the building of a base of Mikdash, then it can be built.
Right?
No, but we're not going to build it. It's being built in the sky by God. Every time we do a mitzvah, he's adding a brick.
Couldn't you just say it was built in a fun mitzvah?
No, those are just the tools. I don't know. We sang that song every day at camp after lunch.
You have to build a model, right, which is, right, so that the form can descend from heaven into the...
It's
not so
cool.
Right. Yeah, and Rishoni Ashkenaz have the Yerushalayim Shel Mata that Shalmala descends in fire. Right. Sorry to my thing. Pardon?
Could someone give a share on this?
Not me. Someone else could if they want. I know very... But Rashi talks about Yerushalayim Shel Mala very...
Which
like
the main flame comes down, or comes down in flame and then it lands in...
Well, what do we really mean by flame?
The Gemara does seem to assume that the Beit HaMikdash might be built as a surprise in a day.
No, the Beit HaMikdash doesn't answer the question of, like, different things about Sphere's home or something like that. But,
yes.
Right? Like, we have all these halachos.
No, but
it would imply that Shem HaYibana Beit HaMikdash...
There are psukim which are cool, right? Yersha Chubra LaYachtav, right? All sorts of things like that.
There's, like, a place name which is, like, whatever, I'll see if I can figure it
out. Okay, fun. Etiquette, sorry, this is a polemic digression. I am not fond of the position that sees Zionism as leading to an inevitable redemption such that any risks are worth taking because, after all, we're never going back again because the Nevi'im said so, only once. The same as Ramban also assures us that Mashiach will arrive in the year by the year 5000, as we all know, which is why we know that Mashiach is coming anytime the next 200 years or so, because Ramban said so. Moshiach has come by the year 5000, and so by the year 6000, he's bound to have come. Ramban says Moshiach has come by the year 5000 or so, right? Because the 7th, the 7th, 6000 is when the world is destroyed. 5000 to 6000 is Yimus HaMashiach.
Well,
right.
Then maybe he just won't come and the world will be destroyed.
No, I have to have Yimus HaMashiach first. But there's a fudge factor in Ramban, if you look at it.
If we don't marry it, then the world has to be destroyed.
No, Moshiach comes whether we marry it or not.
Yeah, it's just like the less good version.
Because every day of creation represents a thousand years, and Adam is Mashiach, so the sixth day. But there's a fudge factor because maybe because I'll think Adam is created late in the day, so that gets us another 625 years or so, right? Depending on when the afternoon starts, and then the whole question is how long? When is can there? But has been Hashmashot that gets you that's what lets you fudge the 1,000 years on both sides a little bit for Ben Hashmashot. Right, and then we have a whole, and then how many years you get the fudge depends on whether you're a brisker, right? Do you get 90 minutes, or do you get 72 minutes, or 40 minutes, or maybe Rabbi Yossi is just clarifying, and according to Rabbi Yossi, it doesn't work at all. But any notion that we know history, right, and therefore, particularly the notion that, which is very prevalent, that because of Ramban, we know that this redemption is the ultimate redemption, because after all, it's occurring on the sixth day. And since only one destruction is mentioned in Nevi'im, therefore, we don't have to worry about the consequences of actions we take as Zionists, because we know this redemption can't be redeemed, and our job is just to go forward no matter what, and that's why we can never consider giving back land. Right? There's a paradox always, because the redemption is inevitable, you shouldn't have to do anything to bring it. Right? But that paradox, is no different than the free will foreknowledge paradox. Everything is planned, that doesn't bother me, right? If people want to fudge the inevitability versus free will paradox, every philosophy in life has to say some of that everything is planned by God, and yet that you're responsible. Right? I dealt with that yesterday in an interview with Beitin, where somebody wanted to resolve the problem of how Yosef's brothers could sell him by saying, after all, it was all part of God's plan. And therefore, you don't have to think worse of the Shvatim for thinking that. So you still have to think worse of the Shvatim. We think badly of Paro, even though the Mitzrayim was exiled. So thinking because of Lakim Chashavala Tava doesn't excuse unless you really want to follow Ritzadok and really believe that certain times God takes away the will of good people to have them do evil actions, so that But I am.
Yosef said it first.
So of course, ultimately, we have a paradox, right? Everything is part of God's plan, but yet you have to have responsibility for your actions. We say everything is part of God's plan, and you can't, then every time you sin, right? Rav Tzedek HaKohen has this amazing notion of tshuva, which intellectually is one of the coolest things imaginable. Right? Rav Tzedek, again, my very, very limited knowledge of Rav Tzedek. Other people tell me Rav Tzedek said this. All right, I have read it in one place, I don't guarantee it. But whether Rav Tzedek said it or somebody else said it for him, it's one of the coolest things you can imagine. It says that since everything is God's will, therefore, tshuva should be heresy. Because tshuva means that you did something that God didn't want. But how could you have done something that God didn't want, right? That's heresy. So the answer is, HaKol B'dei Shemayim Chutz Mi'irat Shemayim. Which means that every action is determined by God. The only thing that you're free about is whether you believe that what you're doing is God's will or not. And tshuva is necessary for the belief that you sinned. Because the belief that you sinned is the belief that you can act independently of God's will. And tshuva is when you recognize that, no, you couldn't possibly have acted against God's will. Right? So tshuva involves completely disclaiming any responsibility for your actions. Right? As long as you believe that you're responsible for your actions, then you are still right, then you're still a chote. Because the chate was believing that you could. Now you want to take that position, right? Then this all works. I don't want to take that position, although I find it intellectually it's just such a cool thing. Right? It deserves applause. It gets an A++++ in any course I'm in if somebody comes up with that independently. But it's horribly frightening. So cool. So cool. It makes so much sense, right? Rationally. Okay. How did I get into that? Oh, we're talking about the notion of what it means of how sin happens, right, and whether it's possible to construct the humanity which is simultaneously free and never sins. Okay, for our purpose, our limited purpose here, what you have is a, right, what the Rav presents you is a portrait of unredeemed existence which sees aesthetics as an end. Now the question is it possible to maintain the sense of aesthetic experience as an end in redeemed existence? Right, so he says that right, unredeemed man is driven solely, right, as the beauty worshipper, seduced by the uncouth and unrefined beauty of Naama and Delilah and Tamar. Right, so that obviously is viewed as a high negative. That is unconfronted existence. The question is, after you have confronted existence, right, does confronted existence necessitate giving up the pursuit, at least, of higher aesthetic pleasures as an end? Or does it mean that ultimately every other kind of experience has to be, right, has to be subordinated to the norm? Right, can you see, right, or, right, are there ways of combining it? You can say that one of, right, that there's a difference about experiencing aesthetic pleasure because God wants you to, and experiencing aesthetic pleasure because He doesn't want you to, and it's no different, there's no reason that the experience of art should be any different than the experience of matzah on Pesach, where Hanoah is part of the mitzvah. Right? That's a way. Right? That's a way of reframing it. Again, you can sublimate it all by saying, you know, by saying that the only time in which aesthetic experience is permitted is when it's Seder mitzvah, and that's. I was very affected by this article in the Jewish Week about the last of these Sukkot. Apparently there was a genre in Europe in the 19th century of people who basically spent their lives painting their Sukkot. And they built these incredible artworks where, you know, the whole Sukkot is an artwork, and every surface of it is covered, and it's an artwork which you just display for 8 days a year. And then you take the Sukkot apart and it goes away again. And only like two or three of these left. And, you know, they have this. One of the central elements of the story is that, you know, it's one great figure, the Stifler, the Chazanish, you know, walking into one of these people's Sukkot, which is one of their ultimate honors. They walk in and they look around and they say, Hider Mitzvah, and they walk out. So that's a big thing, and you can see how, you know, at the end of Sukkot every year, this is their Akedah. Right, you know, we're looking right. You know, in the vision of the Akedah, which is that Avraham takes his chesed, right, and he's makriv his chesed at the Akedah, and that's really what the Akedah is. He's makriv everything, right? Which is a vision of the Akedah they usually fight against, but one should be, you know, it's the dominant, it's the dominant current vision of the Akedah. So you can see how, you know, every year you reenact it, right? You take everything that matters most to you, and you put it, right, you just say, but it doesn't matter unless God wants it. And he only told us to build a sukkah 8 days. So that's a way, which is, right, that's a way of which you say, you know what, you need to, every moment you need to find a way to express that none of this is really important. All that matters, right, all that matters is the command. Or you can have a vision which is not as dichotomous as the Rav, right? Which sees the here's another way of framing it, a religious issue which is along the axis we talked about earlier. There are religious visions, many religious visions, which assume that there can only be one good, and that good ultimately has to be the divine will. That plays. The line of the Rav that expresses this is, a man's religion is everything or it is nothing. That position, as I think Rachel pointed out earlier, comes to an extreme, as I'm told again, in the philosophy of Yeshaya Leibowitz, who argues that there is only one good in religion, which is obedience, although he has the interesting claim that religious, you know, that while the only good in religion is obedience, religion doesn't occupy the totality of your life. And so you're entitled to construct other goods so long as you recognize that those other goods are not religious. Right? And that's where you get the fascinating notion of this human rights crusader, deeply religious human rights crusader, who insists over and over again that his concern for human rights is unrelated to religion. Right? It's fascinating, fascinating, fascinating move. On the Rav-tzedek level, it's a Rav-tzedek level move. Right? To have constructed such a system. You can have another notion in which, within the realm of religion, one sees a variety of goods, which include the good of obedience and the good of self-transcendence and perhaps the good of beauty and things like that. As with many systems, the extreme is more coherent, but it doesn't mean that the extreme is more true. It just means the extreme is more coherent. And in a sense, of course, this is the same paradox that Kabbalah deals with, that all rational philosophy deals with, which is that diversity is the ultimate scandal of any kind of worldview, because any kind of systematic worldview can't account for things existing that are different. So the way both philosophers and Kabbalah express this most deeply by saying that if God is the only existent, so how are they different? So we can solve it, you know, Kabbalistically by claiming that all things are the same, but we perceive them differently, and that generates the problem. But in order to perceive things differently, then we must be different in our perceptions, and that creates the whole problem all over again. So you can try it, you can solve it. You can solve that. You can solve it or not. You can solve it by distinguishing between matter and form. You can go all sorts of ways like that. But right. So I want to right. But that issue is real here, because one vision. What it's a real because one vision says that anybody who sees as the production or experience of aesthetics as an end in itself is religiously problematic, right? Because they're. Another is saying, no, you know what? There are multiple ends, and we can experience knowledge of Torah as an end in of itself, right? You can see Torah lishma can be a religious thread also, right? Because how can you have Torah lishma, which seems that it's not right? Which sees the knowledge of Torah as it, right, or the experience of learning Torah as an end in itself, as opposed to just a means for dveikus, right? And Reb Chaim Volozhin's alleged claim that Talmud Torah is not intended to produce dveikus, right, is a non-totalizing claim, right? It allows for an experience which is something other than a direct experience of God is meaningful, and that is, right, anything lishma, right, in which lishma means for its own sake, as opposed to the sake of the experience of God, is a really challenging thing. Yes, Emily.
What's the defense for the position that it's significant as its own end?
So I say it's not a coherent defense. It's just a claim that maybe there are multiple ends that we give religious value to. We give knowledge of Torah a value. We give kindness to people as per se as a value. And
so, like,
we
what textual basis? I don't know if you need textual basis, but like those other things that you're saying, like, okay, gnut chesedim, you could find like some kind of textual basis for that, like.
So I need a pasuk which teaches me that beauty per se is important.
Okay, but maybe, but that opens up a bigger question of can you like pick subjective values that exist for yourself outside of the confines of Torah versus like does everything need to be justifiable?
And if you find a pasuk that tells you that beauty is important, well, that's very nice for you, but all of a sudden, what have we decided? We decided that what's important is what the pasuk tells us is important, and so we're actually now the authority of school in service of the pasuk in any event.
I'm okay, I think. I think that it would be progress, not as a value statement, but as a descriptive statement, progress toward, if your goal is to, right, is to justify the artistic endeavor per se, if you could say it would be enough to find a pasuk, even if that pasuk has no concrete halachic consequence.
But we don't take pasukim as the foundation of our religious philosophy. I mean, I don't think Judaism has any text which is the foundation of our religious philosophy, does it?
Well,
I don't know.
It seems to be functioning for the Rav as a foundation of religious philosophy.
I think certain philosophers have different foundations. I think Kabbalah is for some, but I don't think, like, whereas there's some consensus about, let's say, Mishnah being the foundation of legal philosophy, or not exactly, but there's some understanding of that. I don't think that there's a philosophical foundational text that's agreed upon.
If Chumash isn't the foundational text, then what is?
I don't think there is one. I don't know if Judaism has a foundational philosophy.
Okay, then what do we do? You know, how do we think? If you
don't
have a foundational philosophy, you have to have something, right? So tell me how I evaluate whether something is worth it, anything. Okay, good. So, I'm okay. If you tell me the standard is you have to find a pasuk which endorses this, I'm okay with that.
But there are pasukim that kind of, that if you talk about what pasukim endorses,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think that there's a non-contradictory vision that would come out of that.
Well, once you allow Kohelet into the canon, that's probably true. Right? Because Kohelet will contradict everything, so you're fine. Okay. You know, that's a problem, but, you know, then you can reduce halacha, right? That's a reductive position to say that we're not allowed to think, all we're allowed to do is do, right? So all that's left is halacha. And when we think about halacha, we can never, right? That's one understanding of the Rav, right? When we think about halacha, you can never talk about why, you can only talk about what, because we are only allowed to engage in descriptive endeavors.
But I think that question leaves the halacha ground. Like, it's not even just about halacha, it's about can you build a value system based on, like, the text that we have.
Yeah, well, a value system, the notion that you can build a value system as opposed to a legal system is itself a strong statement.
Mm-hmm.
So you might make the claim we can't build value systems.
I would never think that you can.
All right, that's because you haven't, you know, internalized particular readings of the halachic man. If you had internalized particular readings of the halachic man, you would never think that you could.
Well, I mean, even if we did, we could make it based on tradition, we can make it based on reading general philosophies, and I mean, we can read it based on sitting in a room and thinking. I mean,
right. The question is, can we do it religiously?
I guess what I'm thinking is that there's no textual proof, if we're using textual proof as our baseline. There's no textual proof that the Bible is supposed to serve as the philosophic foundation for religious philosophy.
I don't know, I might think that Re'ela Chati Lefanecha Tachayim Ve'etatov Ve'etanov Ve'etarah sounds pretty good. I might think that the whole, why is there, you know, that's the answer to the Rashi's question, right, why does the Chumash begin with the Chodesh Hazeh Lachem? Because guess what, the other stuff is really important for building a philosophy of life.
Is that what his answer is?
No, that's what his answer is.
Okay, so
but I look at the Rav does it that way, right, so Rav builds.
Okay, but the fact that Rashi, who's clearly a very influential figure in Judaism's evolution over the years, doesn't think so. I think it's a pretty strong, I mean, you can argue that that's what you choose to do, but I think it's by no means universal or.
I agree. As I said, you can take a position, right? You can take the position that there's nothing outside of halacha. I heard somebody last night was telling me that Rabbi Lamb Were you there? Someone there? Somebody yesterday was telling me that Rabbi Lam got in trouble once because he said that Ein LaKadosh Baruch Hu built Achar Korban Beit HaMikdash Ein LaKadosh Baruch Hu Be'olamo El Adal Adama Shel Halacha Bilvad was a tragedy. Because, of course, a real religious existence should have a lot more than the Adal Adama of Halacha. But after the Beit HaMikdash, Rechman Al-Islam, God was one. Pardon?
It's in Torah
Mada. Yeah, is that wine in Torah Mada?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So I didn't, you know, somebody was writing it orally. I don't remember it from the book. I always loved his line, Halacha is minimal Judaism. Like, that was a terrific line. I love quoting it. You know, of course Jews have to keep Halacha. Then, you know, but after that, you can have a real conversation about what religious life is. But this is exactly the issue here, right? Because if you think that's the case, then you have to tell people who see themselves as experiencing value that you have two choices. Either you find a way to convince me that your value is halacha, is an expression of a halachic obligation.
Or I think you can say that there is a religious philosophy, just not that it's not a, there's no simplistic source for it. You can't say religious philosophy is what Sanders took in or what's that.
Okay, no, I don't think it is. I'm saying, right, so you'll ask me, where does it come from, right? And right, but the deeper question was, if I need a source, so that per se, right, is making me subordinate again, right? It's just subordinating the value ultimately is obedience to Psukim. So I tell you, look, if we can remove the degree of submission from I submit to halacha to I submit to any textual to some textual source in Judaism, that is progress along that axis. On the other hand, you could go really extreme and say that, you know what, we allow you to produce your values out of yourself, right? We talk about the ought from within surging deep profundis, right? Surging from the deep profundis, whatever it is the Rav said, right? And that really Judaism validates any subjective value that is compatible with halacha, right? That would also be a position. Anything that we're fine with any value whatsoever. We may even believe that there is transcendent worth in any value whatsoever, as long as that value is compatible with halacha. Right? That's an extreme position the other way. The problem with that is that it means that halacha per se has no values. Because as long as you can make it practically.
Or not enough values. In that model, you can say that halacha is one value, and as long as your other value system doesn't negate that one value or two values.
Well, you could try and claim that there are certain actions halacha requires which are utterly incompatible with certain values or utterly right. But it's hard to imagine, right? You can always find some way to. The easy way to do it is to claim, you know, is to just claim that this is an important thing to say about halacha generally, right? The easy way to totally negate halacha having any significance for values is to claim that this is a chok. Right? Lotirtzach is a chok. And unfortunately, that means you can't kill people. You can't kill people. We don't understand why, but when a circumstance comes up where you can kill people, so do so with all joy. Right now, you may say, "Look, that's a shocking thing," right? But you understand that's what many people say about homosexuality right now. Right, but homosexuality is a chok. Right, but it doesn't in any way mean that we have any value judgments about the activity. It's just a chok. You don't understand it. If circumstances have come up where it was mutter. Right. Nobody feels any. Nobody should have any resistance to that. There's no reason to oster things in doubtful cases. Right. So we can do that. Right. We do that about homosexuality. We do it about certain things of avdus. We do it about certain things about women's status. So we could do it about lojirtzach. Right. And in fact. Pardon?
I have no objection to that.
I do. I really do. I like to think that we say lojirtzach because we think that killing people is bad. And therefore, even if there's a time when you could conceivably, you know, let's put it this way. Let's suppose I have a fun chakira. In this particular case, and this, it's not even, fundamentally, in some ways, is the machloket between myself and Rabbi Broid about torture and military ethics. Right, so a little lumdishly, right, in war, is lo tirtza chutra or dechuya? Because right, if it's the chuya, so then even though it's mutter to kill people, but of course, if you have two ways of accomplishing the military end, you should choose the end which kills fewer people. But if it's hutra, Well, you know what? There's no iser. So why should I try to find a way to kill fewer people? Isutra, right? Let me get out, right? Let's take out the nuclear weapons. I would much rather that we found some sort of pressure toward killing future people in war if there's no Nafkamina practically. And that it wasn't just that we're looking for, you know, that once we say Milchama is a zone in which Lotirtzach is mutter, so let's take out the nuclear weapons, right? That would deeply disturb me. But I'm frank that there are halachas who take that position. That really we should just, you know, we should look forward to the moment when Lotirtzach is mutter, and then we should feel no compunctions whatsoever if the consequences of our actions are the deaths of people, or for that matter, whether the people we kill are innocent or guilty. As long as it wasn't us to kill them, it shouldn't matter to us in the slightest. Right? So I don't like that position. Yes, Yehuda. Okay, well, there's two polemics in one day. That's probably enough for one day. We should just mention that, you know, confrontation does really get to this end where it talks about where there are two confrontations. There's the confrontation between human beings and the environment, and there's the confrontation between Jews and other human beings. What perhaps is the most useful frame for thinking about that is that both confrontations, the whole purpose of confrontation for the Rav is to generate imperatives. Right? So the notion that Jews confront non-Jews is not designed to tell you that therefore Jews can subdue non-Jews, and it's not designed to create a sense of superiority. Right? The purpose of confrontation of the Rav is to create obligation. And so the way to read, right, so as opposed to reading confrontation solely as an explanation of why interfaith dialogue is under certain grounds is discouraged or rejected or forbidden, whatever kind of language you want to use, which it does talk about, it's also important to read it as an essay which sets out the extent of our obligations both in common with other human beings, because we share the confrontation with around us, and the lost part of the essay is where the Rav says, you know, says that there is an imperative, right, a religious imperative, to stand shoulder to shoulder with Catholics on issues of social justice. Right, that's just, you know, everyone loves quoting the ban against interfaith dialogue, but rarely will you find people quoting this. There is an imperative, right? We must. I'll give you the exact quote you should find. I think shoulder. I should look for the word shoulder because I'm pretty sure he had shoulder in it. Here we are. Right, the Western Jew believes we have to choose, right? But between standing shoulder to shoulder or not. But we stand with civilized. This is the end of section two. Right? We stand with civilized society, shoulder to shoulder. Right, shoulder to shoulder over against an order which defies us all. Right, we are called. We are called upon. Right, we have to. We are human beings committed to the general welfare and progress of mankind, that we're interested in combating disease, alleviating human suffering, and protecting man's rights, and helping the needy, etc. Right. This part of the essay is lost. The more complicated part of the essay is when he right is that he talks about in the same context that he discourages interfaith dialogue of a certain kind, he also tells you that part of the obligation of confrontation is to tell your story to the community you confront, right? And that's a much more challenging thing. But in the short run, what I would say emphasize in the rest of it is that the second confrontation, like the first confrontation, generates norms. And those norms are not only norms that are designed to make you separate, but also norms of responsibility, towards. And that probably is more than enough to one day, since everybody seems to have been exhausted from the start. Turn off tape.